coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am Andrew Farmer, as usual, and also as usual, joining me, the Jedi Cole Houston. Jedi,
I am here in the usual way, and in many ways, in an unusual way.
We called you in the family way, where I'm from.
Okay.
And by that I mean you're like family. That's what right. I mean. So
raises a lot of eyebrows when you're not from that particular part of the country using that regional vernacular, but
it's traditional. It's a traditional vernacular that we use here in the great state of Ohio.
Okay, well there you go.
Different than everywhere else. It's like streams and creeks or soda and pop. It's our own thing.
Right. I'll just use the bubbler.
We made it ourselves. So you find us right smack dab, I guess,
we're off center now. We're off the other end of the center.
Yeah, we're in what would be, if I was in my AP Lit class in high school, I guess this would be the climax, because the fifth one would be the denouement. It would be the falling action. Where we calm ourselves down some. And coming off of the last issue of Hey Kids Comics, in which Cole and I just... We got a ribbon for participation, at least. We did our best to talk about manga.
Is that a ribbon as in the piece of cloth, or a ribbon as in, you know, giving us a real ribbon about that?
Why can't it be both? Let's be honest. No, what's funny is after the show's over, out of the woodwork come people that were like, "Well, I could have come on your show and talked about that." Now you tell us, you bunch of dicks. Tonight we go back into some more familiar territory in this story arc. Cole, what's the story arc?
This is I Think I'm Turning Japanese, and we are on, I actually know the title this time.
Nice.
We are on West Meets East.
West Meets East. And I'm kind of excited about this. There's a lot of stuff that I know that we want to talk about. It's basically one of those things where, so we started, we kind of gave you an overview, we talked about feudal Japan, and sort of the birth of what we consider comic books, you know, and that was eye-opening in the sense that, you know, in large part, that's where all of this comes from. You know, all of this, the reason this show exists is because of what we now know as early manga. And yes, you can write me letters all you want, but I'm saying that. The second issue in the story arc.
It was fascinating to discover that, you know, I often espouse the 100-plus year history of comics, to discover it's a 300-plus year in a sense.
At least 300. I mean, it dates back to the 1400s, which is insane. Like,
this as is my math, apparently.
Well, no, because we did talk about like the 1700s is when it kind of became what we consider sequential art. But, you know,
that's true.
Yeah. 200-300 years before that, there was the first inkling of, okay, you know, this is a story that is being told through sequential art on a scroll with the same character. So, see, if you want to get technical,
when you find out the Magnificent Seven is just a blatant ripoff of the Seven Samurai.
Oh my God, so many blatant ripoffs. We're going to talk about that tonight. That's something we are going to get into in a big way tonight. What was our second issue in this story arc about, Cole?
Our second was, if my memory is, I'll take a page from the chairman on the original Iron Chef, if my memory serves me, and I think it does. We spoke of the rise of the ninja, the mysterious shadow warriors of Japan's past, and how that the mystique and the a complete and total lack of familiarity led to everybody being a ninja.
Just everyone's a ninja. And yep. Then last issue, we made it through manga. We somehow...
Yes, we struggled. We discovered manga, and I was actually looking for some imagery for the website, for the Jedi Call Universe website posting, which finally went up, of the manga issue. And there was one manga, I forget which it was, may have been like Fruits Basket or something like that, or My Son I Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, or I'm going to get in so much trouble for
you
that.
You are
one.
Getting eight letters. I'm going to count them when they come in.
But it may have been Fruits Basket or something, but it was somebody had put together this graphic and touting the X number of million copies in print.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, take that, X-Men.
Right.
really eye-opening to realize that, you know, we think we have these massive print runs in the States, and there's stuff that's just insane in the volume of copies. And I also want to give a shout-out to our good friend Frank Anderson Jr., who was actually published his, I guess, non-manga American strip, Monsterland. Was actually published in a manga compilation book years and years ago.
That's fantastic. Good job, Frank. Also, Frank, Manticore breeder and tamer.
Yes, that's right. So if you're looking for a new Manticore,
famous.
Go Anderson.
Famous for his Manticores.
That's
just,
right.
Just famous. But, you know, you bring up a good point that I think leads us into this issue. And what we're talking about now is sort of the modernization of Japan and the modernization of Japan's influence on the American comic book. And I think it's really, I think we've mentioned it. I would like to say not by design. I think some of it was a little by design, but not by design. We've mentioned it a few times tonight already. And the first thing that came to my mind when I started thinking about this is, why are we obsessed? Right? Why is America obsessed with including thematically and literally Japanese culture into comic books? Like it's one of the top five tropes in every comic. You're eventually going to come to a point where the team jumps a Quinjet or jumps a Blackbird or, you know, or Boom Tube and ends up in Japan. Or they fight ninja, or they fight, they team up with samurai, or
there's some modern day samurai in the picture.
Oh,
or...
my God. Don't get me. I've already been on off recording, and I was already on a samurai tirade, which, by the way, name of my new band, Catch Us Fridays, open mic at, Ruds and Suds. It's going to be great. I'm really excited. But yeah, no, here's the first thought that I had is, I'm going to get letters for this for a completely different reason, but we in this great grand country of ours stand and tout and drape ourselves in tradition. We have,
oh yeah, it's just shy of Reptevia coming in from the milk and the cows, you know.
But everything is the great tradition, the traditions that we have. You know what? I will say this: we are and I'm not going to be exact here, but we are roughly 300-year-old country. Is that about right?
Yeah, pretty much.
300 and maybe a little teetering, but we don't have tradition yet, ladies and gentlemen.
We're over 250.
Okay.
We can definitely count ourselves in the mighty 250s.
Okay. So do you really believe that, and when we talked about and this struck me today as really interesting, when we had our story arc on all the different time periods, whether it be the Arthurian legend knights medieval or the Egyptian or the Greek-Roman time periods. And you started talking about the Victorianization, which is a word that I think I just invented, of all of these concepts and ideas, bringing them in to the Victorian era.
Or the Victorian area. Have you ever been there? It's really nice.
I'm like a dolphin. I constantly keep my Victorian area clear of all detritus that might. We're talking about two different things now, aren't we? I think. Anyway,
thinking of Elizabethan area.
I am thinking of my Elizabeth. What I refer to as my Elizabethan area. Yes. Damn it. Damn it. We talk about tradition. We have absconded with everyone else's tradition, and we call it our own. So you start thinking, okay, so we talked about Shogun, and I'm going to use clans with a C, all right? Let me make real clear that I'm referring to clans with a C. So we start looking at houses and clans in traditional Japan, and even further up, you know, we start talking about Yakuza, which, by the way, we haven't even...
Oh, that's true.
Scratch the damn surface on. It needs its own show. And then we start looking at things like Westerns. And we start looking at things like the K-Bar Ranch. And these groups of cattle rustlers, or these unfair cattle barons that live in their compounds. And the one man, the lone... The family, the guy that fought in the Civil War, and now, you know, these guys came and killed his family because he wouldn't give up his land, has to ride out on his horse to this... Oh, wait, you mean every samurai movie that's ever been made?
Oh, yeah.
Is that what you mean? No, that's our Wild West. We have a tradition of the Wild West.
Superimpose the Wild West over feudal Japan. I think most notably... in the case of the man is originally the man that stabbed a character very much like Liberty Valance.
So the man that stabbed Liberty Valance doesn't have the same ring to it, though.
No, it didn't, because it was just a lot of, you know, katana stabbing.
just so much, just over and over again. So we don't what I was referring to is we don't have tradition, and then we look at something like the rich history of Japan, the things that we read and we see from this land that has been recorded history from what, the 1200s, the 11, just too far back to even really conceptually understand when you're an American, when you're born here and you're like, George, but we crossed the Delaware and then like, yeah, great, like that,
yeah, like
happened
1,000 years after
right, blink of an eye,
cultural advances and gunpowders, and
so of course we take their mythology and their traditions and we make them our own. That's what we do. We are a melting pot, and that's what makes us great. That's why it makes sense that we have incorporated thematically these ideas into our modern comics. And then you come up with this begrudging respect for industry. This, that's the best way I can put it, is this begrudging respect for industry, which we spoke to, I believe, in the first or second issue.
I believe it was in the first issue. Yes, indeed.
And you couple that into the modern era, the modern era of comic books. So all of a sudden you have this updated mythology and tradition coupled with respect. And the sad part about it is, and we'll get into this later, we talked about this a little bit in show prep too, is that it took them, God, I don't know, 20, 30 years, it took American comic books to finally start to get it right, to where it wasn't like racisty homages to their culture, to the Japanese culture.
Yeah, there's a long history that we're going to address in a future issue of thinly veiled to blatant kind of racist overtones or overtures that run rampant in comics. And a lot of it, is it forgivable for its period? Not necessarily, but it exists because of the period from which it comes. And you see a lot of, it's almost like the hangers-on from the era of World War II.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of get away with it because you're mocking the enemy and you're belittling them. And but then it perpetuates into the 50s and into the 60s. And then you begin to see a lot more cultural respect
Yes.
start to edge
Trickle.
its way in, I guess.
Well, it's an attempt to do right ham-fistedly. We always
Yeah.
talk about the ham-fisted in on this show, but it's an attempt to do right ham-fistedly, and it's just it comes out the other side. However they made that sausage, it's a bitter sausage. It's a bitter sausage to eat. But we digress. That's sort of where I wanted to start because it sets the tone for this issue is in this idea of a tradition and this idea of a respect and an attempt to, and let's be honest, right? We talk about cash grabs, and it's an attempt to tell another story now that you have this door that's open and you, oh, I can play in this world now.
Yes, indeed. Well, yeah, we did mention, especially in the first issue of this arc, that there was a bit of a cash grab stylistically,
Oh God, yeah.
where you begin to see, like, let's put out some either blatant, like, Marvel manga that we mentioned, or let's hire the artists who are clearly mimicking the manga styles that are
Right.
popular. And down to the point to jump off of comics onto a spin-off, the at least for me, and apologies, no, actually no apologies.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, not yeah, I'm not gonna apologize for this. The god awful what I call Teen Titans, where it's just this
Oh.
exaggerated anime.
Careful. There are a lot of people that love that
Oh, I
show.
know. And it's introducing into a what was a decidedly really amazing series from DC. All of the manga, anime, cash grab. It's the thing is, it's awkward to me. That's the issue that I have with these things, is there's this sort of awkwardness because it's just so obviously, so obvious that we're not, the only reason we're doing it this way is to attract an audience
Yeah,
rather
yeah.
than telling good tales, and just let's steal the what do I call it, tear sweat
Oh
or sweat
God,
sweat
Cole was
sweat tears from,
yelling
yes, I
off
don't
mic.
understand the sweat tears, or that the facial hashtag. I see a
Well,
lot of manga.
I think my thing is it doesn't translate. Right? I've come to realize and having new respect for the medium and the art of manga. That this show this we always say what we want to do is change your relationship with comic books. We want to change the way you read them and think about them and see them. That's the whole point of this show. That's what we hope you get that's different than every other show that you listen to. It has changed my relationship with the way that I think about manga. And it The problem with my problem with the difference of manga and anime in this animated form is that the tear sweat and the hashtags and the surprise eyes, all of those things, while they work perfectly well, I feel in comic book form, in manga form, paper form, they just don't translate to moving pictures that well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about.
No, I want to talk about tear
Oh
sweat.
yeah, well,
No, I'm
the tear
good.
sweat comes in because you are getting. What's interesting though is there's that uncomfortable kind of cash grabby. Let's appropriate this form that the reason it's popular in the States is because it's unique
Yeah.
to another country, and it's being translated into English, which means the entire book has to be reversed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's
Because
absolutely accurate.
if you've ever seen manga, published manga in its original Japanese, you're like, well, I put the spot on the wrong side,
Like, no, they didn't. No,
they
you're
not.
on the wrong side.
Yeah, you're just it literally is East meeting West when you put a translated copy with an original copy. But the thing about it is, there are those that just feel like, it's just such a cash grab. We're just trying to bank on this bankable style and all, and the hype and the FUD and the love. And then you get those who get away with it because they're not trying to you can see there's a difference between being influenced by something and simply copying it. Where it becomes like, you know, the pre-Renaissance, everyone on their Raphael hobby horse, copying the works of the old masters and never deviating in the least.
So do go on. I'm just curious. Do go on.
And then you get people who get away with it because you can tell the anime or the manga and anime influencers are there, but they are using their actual personal style bears the marks of influence without being copyists. And foremost among these is someone I cannot believe didn't cross my mind when we were doing our ninja episode, probably because it only has his work only has a vague connection to that topic.
Okay.
And that is Ninja High School creator Ben Dunn.
Oh, Ben. Yes. Ben, who was, I might say, was we might have slandered a little bit in the last issue when we were talking about Marvel manga, because he was involved in that project in some degrees.
I see that more as like Marvel reaching out to him because they imagined he was a manga artist, or that he was, you know, that his work was doing exactly what they were doing, which is just, you know, manga ripoff.
Right.
But, you know, he was doing things like Ninja High School and Mighty Tiny and a lot of other stuff that was reminiscent and celebratory of a lot of Japanese culture that was being imported at the time without just being an absolute blatant ripoff or, you know, there's anything from tribute to ripoff. And so I think in many ways he gets away with that because it's some sort of due reverence rather than just like, you know, I chose this style because it's bankable. It's going to get me sales.
Right. This, I mean, it's, I love
because
Ben Dunn.
You see that a lot where things aren't getting sales because they're crap, but you can tell that the artists or the creative team were heading more toward a manga style in hopes of that being enough to carry the book.
Right. I agree wholeheartedly. So let's talk about some of the modern iterations of some of our, because now we're into what I'm looking at is like your Silver Age, your modern age heroes. I kind of want to push it post World War II because otherwise it gets a little rough, and we don't need to go there, frankly. But there are some really interesting characters out there that they have introduced that are really cool. And so what we were talking about prior, right, was we have this idea that at some point the comic industry woke up to say we need to be more inclusionist when it comes to all of our heroes, our characters. If you harken back to what we've talked about, and if you're an old Marvel fan, you'll remember the dreaded Contest of Champions. Contest of Champions was this idea that Marvel had, and I believe it was the precursor to the Secret Wars and all of that. If I'm not mistaken, you'll have to.
Yeah, I believe you are correct. It was a 3-issue miniseries that gave us the Grandmaster.
It did, which we've now seen on the big screen.
That's right. And in very much a let's see here, it's very in very much a kind of it literally is the precursor because it's sort of like the Grandmaster drawing everybody together in the same way the Beyonder does, or in a way similar to the way the Beyonder does, to kind of like gather as much of the Marvel Universe as possible into one place. And to kind of flesh out Marvel's Earth, they felt compelled to – the Grandmaster was drawing combatants, contestants from all over the Earth.
Right.
And to tell this story, they needed a much richer Earth. They had some characters that like Sunfire with the X-Men, who, you know, this was sort of like, in many ways, rather frighteningly like when Professor X goes around in Giant Size X-Men number one and X-Men number 94 and goes and gathers the new X-Men by
Yes.
driving around all over the Earth and picking
Yes.
up mutants here and there. Like, oh, here's the one Russian mutant.
Get in.
Apparently, the People's Republic aren't going to care that you're taking the guy who can do the work of 100 men by himself without the necessity of machinery, who, by the way, destroys some very valuable state machinery when he could have just like
Picked it
stopped
up.
it out
Yeah,
with
he
his
could have picked
hands.
it up.
But you know, he goes around and like finds an African mutant and a Japanese mutant and a Russian mutant. So, you know, Contest of Champions required finding more superheroes in other countries
Well, and
to
that's
go and see and find and grab and make them contestants. And so many of them are just, they're not really racist, but they're just sort of stereotype. Like, who is it? Little, lucky, Shamrock, I think it was.
Shamrock, yes. Well, luckily
Yeah,
for.
of course, Good Luck Mutant would be born in Ireland.
Well, of course they would. And so would Arabian Knight, which is just lazy.
Oh, yeah, that was just like a gimme. Like someone, like any Arab man who had superpowers would decide to dress up like Ray Harryhausen's Sinbad or something and run around like some kind of stupid Hollywood stereotype with a scimitar. And yeah, so then you get, what do we do about China? Who's the People's Republic? Who's going to be their
Yeah.
champion? Why, it's none other than Collective Man, who can draw on the power, on the energy of the entire nation. So I guess if you didn't have happened to be born in China, and or do expats count? I don't know. It was never
Right.
medically explored.
At what point are you no longer Chinese? You know, it's,
Yeah,
but
exactly. Where do you fall out of the collective?
luckily for I believe he was on, yeah, Death's team, because it was Grandmaster versus Death in the chess match that was the Contest of Champions. Japan already had its superhero, and in that, and you hearkened back to when that character came into being when you were telling that story about Professor X driving across country, Thelma and Louise style, picking up Brad Pitts from every country,
That's right.
and that was no other than Sunfire, which I think, if we really look at it, was sort of the hearken and the trigger to say, okay, we get it. And I think so many of these, you know, that, and we've talked about the X-Men and what they've done with social issues. I think that that was a very important book, because if you look at the book, that particular book, the book that brought us Sunfire, you also get in that mix, you got, it wasn't Warpath at that point. It was God, was it James Proudstar, or which Proudstar was it? It was
Oh gosh,
Thunderbird.
yeah.
Thunderbird.
Yeah, Dunderbud.
You got Dunderbird. You got Storm. You got Colossus. You got Nightcrawler, hearkening from Germany.
Yeah.
So you've got this. Now you've got this kind of unilateral United Nations of mutants out there. And they finally, it clicked and said, hey, we can't be exclusionist anymore. We've done damage. It's time to start trying to bridge that gap. And Sunfire was an amazingly complex character for his time, because we go back to talking about tradition and industry. And that's what we pictured Sunfire as being at that point. Now, awesome, he had awesome fire powers too, and
Yes,
later.
atomic fire, no
Yeah,
less.
and
Not just
later
like regular fire, but atomic fire.
later became a Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and led Big Hero 6. But yeah, you know, he was that at that point in time when he was introduced, which was in the 70s, he had the stereotypical, I'm not going to call it racist, but I am going to call it stereotypical idea of what Americans thought about Japanese. The
Yeah.
Japanese, which was industrious, stern, taciturn, very much, you know, a taskmaster. So
yes,
so it, he didn't have time to play your games, you know, Nightcrawler. He didn't have time to explain himself to you, Cyclops. He had things that needed to be done, and he was going to do them. Now, that is, again, that is what we thought as a nation about a people in the 70s and 80s. We've talked about the movies in reference to this. Gung Ho was one of them where, you know, it was one of my favorite movies of all time. Mr. Baseball, all of these depictions of Japan at the time featured very taciturn, very driven, very traditional people with all of these, you know, complicated traditions that we just didn't understand.
Exactly.
So we created a strange mythology around seppuku and you know, the Japanese boss and the salary man and the Japanese worker and, you know, with the karaoke, what Japanese did for fun and all of this weird stuff. But I think Sunfire really was the push in the right direction, whether they got it right or not.
Absolutely. And you have a long tradition of Asian and especially Japanese characters in the comics.
Yes.
And you get this sort of combination of reverence and just blatant misunderstanding. A lot of it is, you know, carrying over the this sort of mystery of, you know, nobody's really entirely certain. So we draw from assumptions and such about Japanese culture. And like you're saying, that's where you wind up with the characterization of Sunfire in many ways. But you're also seeing an emergence from that kind of, I think one of the things that articulated this best was the, there was a character in the early Green Lantern mythos.
Oh, no.
Who appears in the New Frontier comic, albeit briefly.
Okay.
And it's literally this wonderful addressing of almost like an atonement for the past, where I believe it's Hal Jordan comes and refers to this guy as Moonface.
Yes, it is.
Which was his – that was what the character was known as in the comics back then.
Ugh, God, it hurts.
And the character calls him out on this.
Yeah, in the comic.
And in the comic, and I thought, what a wonderful nod to what we just sort of let go. And it was just acceptable that you would have this character called Moonface. It was like the vaguely racist Pickaninny character in The Spirit.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was, I wouldn't go so far as to call Will Eisner, you know, intentionally trying to be blatantly racist, but I think in kind of making a nod to the ways of comics, it becomes an uncomfortable kind of thing. And it was sort of like somebody, the writer, sort of addressing the fact that there's this, you know, we should be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yes. We should be. Okay, so we shouldn't, if not uncomfortable, we should be answerable to what we did. We should be forced to look at it, you know, regardless of how comfortable or uncomfortable you are with the situation, we should be forced to acknowledge that it happened, at least. And I think
that was a great acknowledgement and a move forward. Let's acknowledge that mistakes were made and push forward instead of just, leaving it be. This was a character that would otherwise have disappeared into the background.
Well, they could have, and we've talked, you know, at length about New Frontier, and I think it's in my top 10 comics of all time. It's brilliant. But they could have done 3 pages of explanation. They could have gone if it would have been Bendis or Geoff Johns, we would have gotten 3 pages of exposition as to why we shouldn't call him Moonface, you know, but they left it at a couple panels. and then let you feel that brevity. And I think that that did more for it than you lashing me with your social justice switch that I had to fetch.
Exactly.
So let's talk for a second about the Way of the Samurai, shall we? I think it's time.
I think we have to, because this, if the ninja is king of Japanese cultural, historical, and mythological influence on comics, the samurai is kind of a viceroy or a duke.
We said in the ninja issue that everyone's a ninja. At some point, everybody gets to be the ninja. Everybody gets to play dress up and be the ninja. If you were able to punch a guy and stand in a shadow, you were a ninja.
That's right. But the thing about it is, it's kind of like the axiom of, be yourself unless you can be Batman.
Right.
And if you can't be a ninja, be a samurai. Those who are not ninja, by default, would become samurai, ronin, etc., etc. I don't know.
Holy
all the
shit,
terms.
Cole! That was real. That just
Magic 8-Ball didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, that just cleared everything up for me. That was deep, and I'm not kidding. Because when we start thinking about it, okay, if you're on the Justice League and you're not Batman. If you're in the world's finest and you're not the ninja, you're the look around the room. If you don't see the samurai, you're the samurai.
Yes, absolutely. You see, because and world's finest is the perfect example of the ninja samurai team
dynamic.
Yes, so they must out of necessity work together.
But you've also got characters that whoever the writer is has decided that they're both Wolverine being a big one. He's the samurai. No, he's the ninja. Well, I mean, come on, guys. Let's just give me one and let it stick. And we were talking before the show that I think that the samurai, the concept of the samurai or the idea of the Bushido samurai is probably the most played out hackneyed comic book idea I can think of, because I can't think of anyone that they didn't apply the samurai formula to at some point. Superman got to be a samurai and then got to be a ronin when he left masterless to wander the earth. Like another character that we should, the pop culture reference of all time that has gone without being mentioned, which is wander the earth like Kane in Kung Fu.
That's right.
God damn.
So many characters go town to town getting adventures, meet
yeah.
people.
Yeah. The Hulk. You could also definitely throw Captain America in that mix.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Captain America was one of the first that came to my mind when I was beginning to articulate that realization that, if you're not a ninja, you're a samurai, just almost universally. You want to talk about the Ronin, the masterless samurai? Look no further than Robin, not Ronbin.
Ronbin?
Look, Ronbin.
Are you having a stroke? Or do we need to call someone?
No, he's juxtaposing Robin and Ronin, because in many ways, Batman is the Bushido lord. He is the shogun. And Robin the samurai, who then becomes the masterless samurai and wanders and evolves into Nightwing and Red Robin and becomes a burger chef or something. I'm not sure what was going on with that.
A burger chef?
Red Robin, yum.
Oh, no. Oh, no, yum. That's bad. There is one samurai though that can't go. We can't go this entire issue, and I fear that we will without mentioning a small company named Solson Publications. Back on January 1st, 1986, published a comic. They had a a grand idea. They had a brilliant idea conceptually, and they said, you know, we need to ask a question, and that question is, what does Santa do 364 days of the year when he's not delivering presents on that one fateful day? Apparently, what you didn't know was that he was a samurai.
Indeed.
Yes. So if you can find Samurai Santa number one, which for 86, a $2 cover price was expensive, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, a lot of indies were pretty pricey just out of, you know, the inherent necessities of low print runs, or the consequence, I guess you would say, of low print runs.
But what's really interesting about that is, and if we want to go off topic just even a little bit, the inker on this particular book was none other than Comics Jim Lee. Way back
Indeed. Wow.
In 1986, Jim Lee inked Samurai Santa, which, by the way, has recently sold November 20. Oh my God. I just clicked an eBay link for this thing, Cole. Are you ready for this? Sold on eBay as recently as November 21st, 2017. So that's like 2 months ago.
Wow.
For $250.
Good Lord.
Somebody really wanted to. I was thinking I would pick up a copy. That ain't going to happen now.
Yeah.
You can have it for $250. I'm sorry, Samurai Santa. Not running down that road. That is not a hill I'm willing to die on for you. But yeah, the samurai, the concept of the samurai, why do you feel that it's such an interesting concept and we gloom to it constantly?
I think it because there is, it becomes a bit like your medieval knights.
Sure.
Because there is anything where you have a cultural history, a code of ethics or behaviors that is deeply held, and you have a number of other just aspects that help mystify something that probably wasn't as mystical in reality in many respects. But I mean, if you poke around, you can find all kinds of samurai stuff, especially in the indie comics. Samurai Penguin was a comic that came from Slave Labor Graphics, who were publishing all kinds of stuff. They were fairly successful indie publisher back in the day. About the same time, you would also find The Adventures of Samurai Cat or something like that, which was another anthropomorphic samurai book. And then there were things like, I discovered just kind of poking around, there was a book called Madam Samurai, which I think may have been a digital comic, but Afro Samurai was one that came out of this period. And there was a book simply called Samurai that was kind of a modern samurai tale. And of course, you know, you had all kinds of other samurai running rampant in the comics. Mm-hmm. During the ninja period, you know, Silver Samurai, old X-Men villain, would often resurface to remind you that if you're not a ninja, you're a samurai.
Here you go. Just, you want some of this sweet samurai action? How many issues has it been? Seven? Yeah. Yeah, here I come.
Air Cell was the publisher on the samurai book there.
I want to take a sec. We aren't running too long in the tooth. I want to take a second to acknowledge my favorite best worst Japanese comic book. American comic book about Japanese superheroes. Okay? So way back in the Wayback Machine, 2008, my favorite modern comic book writer, Grant Morrison, who, you know, I will consistently auditorily fellate every chance I get, had a concept on the heels of Final Crisis. Do you remember Final Crisis?
I remember Final Crisis.
I wish I didn't remember Final Crisis.
I think we still had the comic shop back in the Final Crisis days.
I really wish
I probably have some out in long boxes out in the garage even still.
I'm sorry. You have my apologies for that. It was interesting. But Grant Morrison brought the idea of the Great Ten, which was the Chinese super group.
Yeah.
Also brought the idea of a Japanese super group known as the Super Young Team. The Super Young Team consisted of the most excellent Super Bat, Big Atomic Lantern Boy, Crazy Shy Lolita Canary, Shiny Happy Aquazon, Well-Spoken Sonic Lightning Flash, and Sunny Sumo. These were the names of characters in this comic book, ladies and gentlemen, written by Grant Morrison.
It sounds like bad translations of American movie titles.
But that's what it's supposed to be, right? Is that thing that we have for bad translations that we all feel guilty about laughing about, but we still do, and it sucks, but we love it. The whole concept of this team was that they were inspired by American superheroes, your Batmans, your Green Lanterns, your Flashes. So they created their own team, and this was the team they created. So Most Excellent Super Bat was the Superman-Batman analogy, but he sucked, right? He was rich, he had tech, but he sucked. The Atomic Lantern Boy was he shot green force beams, but he was the Green Lantern analogy. The Lolita Canary was a winged character that was so small she could fit in somebody's hand, that possessed a sonic scream. Shiny Happy Aquazon, the daughter of Junior Waveman, which was a member of another team, which was Big Science Action. And then Well-Spoken Lightning Flash, which was a speedster. Sunny Sumo, sumo wrestler with healing abilities. But the whole concept of the group was that they... And in all honesty, I read the book. I read Dance. It was great. Because the thing is, as batshit insane as Grant Morrison is, and he is batshit insane, he can write a book. But yeah. It's nuts. So if you want to read a crazy-ass, Japanese-based, pop culture-influenced American comic book, give Dance a try. Just don't write me letters. I've warned you in advance. Don't write me letters. Oh, man. Yeah, there you go.
I think we have to talk about, very briefly, a sort of samurai phenomenon that came out of a period where you had things like Green Arrow Longbow Hunters.
Okay, yes.
Where you brought in the character of Shadow.
Yes.
Or somebody I used to work with at Diamond pronounced it Shadow.
You're like, no.
Like, seriously, Shadow. And so you had... this artist, young artist, comes up out of nowhere and becomes a huge sensation for several years.
Okay.
By the name of Billy Tucci.
Oh, Billy. She. Oh.
Yeah, she, S-H-I, was such a groundbreaking, or, just phenomenal out of nowhere. There was actually somebody marketed statuary. There was this huge, like, collectibles buzz for a while around this, what would otherwise have been just another obscure indie.
Yeah.
And it spun off a Tomoe.
Yeah.
Well, the other characters.
Tomé, I think, maybe. I don't know.
Mel Torme.
Yep.
Comic, yeah, the Velvet Fog, who would actually, in the comic, could just create fogs.
Just two, though. Two fogs.
That's right.
I want to see that comic. Bad. The Mel Torme comic. Yes.
Mel Torme Adventures is what it was called.
The Mel Torme Adventures.
But that was one that just was a mofo for a while there, and then just faded into obscurity. And if you're unfamiliar, it was like the who was that did all like the posters and the all the prints in the 80s with the albino hot chicks. His work appears on the Duran Duran's Rio album. And,
Damn it. And also on, I'm guessing, unlicensed on every nail salon in your town.
That's right. you know, so it looked like one of his characters in a bare midriff quilted Japanese, you know, some sort of geisha girl number. It was a spicy little geisha number.
So don't Dana Carvey this show, man. It's not necessary.
But they
sorry, go ahead.
Just had to get that out there. And then the only other one of note that I could think of in, you know, in the samurai aspect of the Japanese cultural influence was, I remember on like Free Comic Book Day one year having a copy of Ronin Hood and the 47 Samurai.
Ronin Hood?
Ronin Hood. This was back in 2005.
Do you remember anything about Ronin Hood?
Not much. There was, I remember the cover. I think that this was like a sampler for a greater graphic novel.
Yeah. That's awesome. That is great. I'm trying to think. My favorite. There have been so many influences, but we have yet to talk about, and I think maybe this will be our closing argument. We have yet to talk about Japan itself. As you know what, no, Colt, you know what you didn't talk about, and I'm going to leave the floor to you.
Uh-oh. What have I missed?
We missed a certain giant robot that fights things like Godzilla tonight, Colt.
Oh, yes, indeed. Speaking of Ronin, none other than Red Ronin, and speaking of, like, borrowing or appropriating or utilizing popular Japanese culture, Red Ronin first appears in the licensed Godzilla comic.
That's right.
I believe Marvel was the first to, but not the last, to import Godzilla to the States in comic book form. Later on, Dark Horse did some Godzilla comics, and then we talked about, you had brought up that very clever series that was a number of historical tales taking actual events and just sort of inserting Godzilla into them. And so I think, yes, absolutely. The combination of the Godzilla comic and then also a Japanese import remarketed in toy form, or Japanese toys that were remarketed in the States as the Shogun Warriors.
Yes, yes.
Also enjoyed a rather long-running comic. And oddly enough, this will blow your mind.
Okay.
Megatron first appears in the pages of Shogun Warriors.
You are kidding.
Not the Megatron who can turn himself into a gun and shrink down to hand size,
which is
in the cartoons.
Baffling beyond recognition.
Yeah, just, I don't know what's going on there. It's like some sort of like reverse TARDIS thing going on. But they just let that steep a second. And then, but what's amazing, I think it was Bill Mantlow who wrote Shogun Warriors, would later go on to be hired by Hasbro to create the names and backstories of their Transformers line.
That's crazy.
And whether by accident or design, recycled the name of a one-off villain, Megatron.
That's awesome. I can't think of a better way to end this issue than that. So,
it's got everything. It's got samurai and Ronin and Shoguns and Godzilla, and you know, you go Godzilla.
You go, damn it. All right, just plug us up. I think you just made an Edgar Winter joke. I think it was the first time in 256 issues You made a Go-Go Godzilla joke on a comic book podcast. I think that we can hang it up for the night. So
absolutely.
Go ahead and plug us up.
It's as good a place to end as any. I do want to give a quick shout out to Dallas area artist Terry Parr.
Terry Parr.
That I'd forgotten in our ninja episode. He did a comic called Aerobicide, the Extreme Ninja Workout.
Oh, did he?
Which apparently takes place in the 80s, which is rather fitting.
Yes.
The write-up I found was it's the 1980s. Venice Beach has been taken over by weightlifting gangs, yuppies, and evil ninjas.
That's fantastic.
And what I was aware of Aerobicide, and I knew that it was some kind of like ninja workout theme thing going on. I did not realize that he brilliantly set that in the 80s. So absolutely everything makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that's Terry for you. He's an amazing dude, Terry Parr is. All right, get us out of here.
All right, we are, of course, coming to you from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com, home of Hey Kids Comics, and another show is going to be coming back soon. So if you happen to catch the Rancor Pit live on DallasOnAir.com on Sunday morning, the Sunday 21st, I believe that is, where Eddie and I will be talking about our favorite Star Wars comic covers. We're going to judge books by their cover. Oh, God, it's going to be amazing.
I wish I could be there.
We will be, that is 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Central on DallasOnAir.com. 1 hour before that, from 9:30 to 10:30 Central, you can catch the sixth episode, Aisle 6 of Isle of Toys, where my special guest will be Brett Weiss, a published author of a variety of books on console gaming, and we're going to talk about everything from Pong straight through to whatever the hell these giant helmet head things are that people play.
God, with you sound the train. So old. You goddamn kids and giant helmet head things.
It was a helmet head virtual BS thing.
Goddamn heads out of your goddamn asses long enough to count the job down with your goddamn helmet heads.
All right. But, you know, be sure and check that out on DallasOnAir.com. Also want to give a big special shout out, even though it's drastically unrelated, to our friends over at Holocron Toys in Fort Worth, Texas, who are having their grand opening on the 20th. Over on Vickery Street in Fort Worth. Be sure and check that out. It's an amazing Star Wars store. I had a blast out there at their soft opening, and then we'll be out there for their grand opening as well. And be sure and drop us a line every now and again at heykidscomics@gmail.com.
There you go. Twitter and Instagram in full effect for this show, HK Comics Show. Speaking of soft opening, I'm going to get out of here and go take care of my Victorian area. Please join. God damn it! I can't even keep going. Join us next week when
he's having a tutor period.
You have no idea. You don't know what I had for lunch. God, fart jokes, man. This episode has everything. This is free, folks. It's a free show. Next week we talk about future Japan, Neo Tokyo Japan, Rai. It's Valiant. Look it up. You'll love it. All right. So join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye, collect and enjoy.